recall from my boyhood instruction as being the egotism of Satan. He would not bow to man. Mm-hmm. But in this view, he could not bow to man because of his love for God. He could bow only to God. And then God says, get out of my sight. Now, the worst of the pains of hell, insofar as hell has been described, is the absence of the beloved, which is God. So how does Iblis sustain the situation in hell? By the memory of the echo of God's voice when God said, go to hell. And I think that's a great sign of love, do you see?
Well, it's certainly true in life that the greatest hell one can know is to be separated from the one you love.
Yeah.
That's why I've liked the Persian myth for so long. Satan as God's lover.
Yeah. And he is separated from God, and that's the real pain of Satan.
You once took the saying of Jesus, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you so that you may be sons of your Father who's in heaven, for he makes the sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and the unjust. You once took that to be the highest, the noblest, the boldest of the Christian teachings. Do you still feel that way?
Well, I think the main teaching of Christianity is love your enemies.
Hard to do.
I know. Well, that's it. I mean, when Peter drew his sword and cut off the servant's ear there in the Gethsemane affair, and Jesus says, put up your sword, Peter, and put the ear back on. Peter has been drawing his sword ever since. And one can speak about Petrine or Christianity in that sense. And I would say the main doctrine of Christianity is the doctrine of agape, of a true love for him who is your enemy.
How does one love one's enemy without condoning what the enemy does, accepting his aggression?
Well, I'll tell you how to do that. Do not pluck the mote from your enemy's eye, but pluck the beam from your own, do you know? Now, I have a friend whom I met by chance, a young Buddhist monk from Tibet. You know, in 1959, the communists crashed down and bombed the palace of the Dalai Lama, bombarded Lhasa, and people murdered and all that kind of thing. And the escape. He escaped at the time of the Dalai Lama. And those monasteries, I mean, there were monasteries with 5,000 monks, 6,000 monks, all wiped out, tortured, and everything else. I haven't heard one word of incrimination of the Chinese from that young man. There is absolutely no condemnation of the Chinese here. And you hear this from the Dalai Lama himself. Yeah. You will not hear a word of condemnation. This recognition of the way of life through which that vitality of the spirit is moving in its own way. I mean, these men are sufferers of terrific violence. And there's no animosity. I learned religion from that.
Do most of the stories of mythology from whatever culture say that suffering is intrinsically a part of life and that there's no way around it?
I think I'd be willing to say that they do. I can't think of anything now that says if you're going to live, you won't suffer. It'll tell you how to understand and bear and interpret suffering. That it will do. And when the Buddha says there is escape from suffering, the escape from sorrow is nirvana. Nirvana is a psychological position where you are untouched by desire and fear.
But is that realistic? Does that happen?
Yes, certainly.
And your life becomes what?
Harmonious, well-centered, and affirmative of life.
Even with suffering?
Exactly. There's a passage in Paul's epistle to the Philippians, isn't there? be as Christ, for Christ did not think Godhood something to be hung on to be clung to, but let go and came down and took life in the form of a servant even unto death. Let's say, come in and accept the suffering and affirm it.
So you would agree with Abelard in the 12th century who said that Jesus' death on the cross was not as ransom paid, as a penalty applied, but it was an act of at-one-ment, atonement, at one with the race.
That's the most sophisticated interpretation of why Christ had to be crucified. Abelard's idea was that this is connected with the Grail King and everything else, that the coming and of Christ to be crucified and illustrating thus the suffering of life removes man's mind from commitment to the things of this world in compassion. It's in compassion with Christ that we turn to Christ. And so the injured one becomes the Savior. It is the suffering that evokes the humanity of the human heart.
So you would agree with Abelard that mankind yearning for God and God yearning for mankind in compassion met at that cross?
Yes, and by contemplating the cross, you are contemplating the true mystery of life. And that love for this experience, no matter how horrific the experience, the love for it.
So there's joy and pain in love.
Yeah, there is. Love, you might say, is the burning point of life. And since all life is sorrowful, so is love. And the stronger the love, the more that pain, but love bears all things. Love itself is a pain, you might say, that is the pain of being truly alive.
As Joseph Campbell pursued his quest across Europe for the stories of love and chivalry, he paused often to visit the great cathedrals. They, too, reflected the glory of love, the love of Mary, Mother of God. Reverence for the power of the female is another grand theme in ancient mythology. In the primitive planting cultures, woman contributed importantly to the economic life of the community by participating in the growing and reaping of crops. And as the mother and nourisher of life, she was thought to assist the earth symbolically in its fertility. In fact, some believe there was even a golden age of the goddess until she was driven from the imagination by the emergence of patriarchal authority. Of late, however, scientists have resurrected the name of an ancient goddess, Gaia, to express the idea of earth as a living body on which we depend for life. In the last half of this conversation with Joseph Campbell, he takes us back to the time when the love of God meant the love for Mother Goddess, and he unites these themes in one image, the virgin birth, which to him represents the birth of spirit from matter, the birth of compassion in the heart.
The Lord's Prayer begins, "Our Father, which art in heaven."
Yeah.
Could it have begun, "Our Mother"?
This is a metaphorical image. This is a symbolic image. And to make the point that it's not your father, your physical father, we have our Father who art in heaven. But heaven, again, is a symbolic idea. Where it would heaven be? It is no place. All of the references of religious and mythological images are to planes of consciousness, are fields of experience, potential in the human spirit. And these are to evoke attitudes and experiences that are appropriate to a meditation on the mystery of the source of your own being, I would say. So there have been systems of religion where the mother is the prime parent, the source, and she's really a more immediate parent than the father, because one is born from the mother, yeah. And then the first experience of any infant is the mother, so that the image of woman is the image of the world. You might say that mythology is simply a translation of the world into a mother image. We talk of Mother Earth and so forth.
But what happened along the way, Joe, to this reverence that in primitive societies was directed toward the goddess figure, the great goddess, the Mother Earth? What happened to that?
That comes in primarily with agriculture and the agricultural societies.
Fertility and all of that?
It has to do with the earth. The human woman does give birth as the earth gives birth to the plants. She gives nourishment as the plants do. So woman magic and earth magic are the same. They are related. And the personification then of this energy which gives birth to forms and nourishes forms is properly female. And so it is in the agricultural world of ancient Mesopotamia, the Egyptian Nile, but also in the earlier planting culture systems that the goddess is the mythic form that is dominant.
Because of this obvious perception of creation issue.
That's right. And when you have a goddess as the creator, it's her own very body that is the universe. She is identical with the universe. And in Egypt, you have the Mother Heavens, Nut, the goddess Nut, who's represented as the whole heavenly sphere.
I was really taken when we went to Egypt upon first seeing the figure of Nut in the ceiling of one of those temples.
Yes, I know the temple.
It's overwhelming.
Yes.
There's one scene of her swallowing the sun.
The idea is that she swallows the sun in the west and gives birth to the sun in the east, and it passes through her body at night. And so she is the heavens.
So it would be natural for people trying to explain the wonders of the universe to look to the female figure as the explanation for what they saw in their own lives.
Not only that, but then when you move to a philosophical point of view, the female represents what in the Kantian terminology we call the forms of sensibility. The female represents time and space itself. She is time and space. And the mystery beyond her is beyond pairs of opposites. So it isn't male and it isn't female. It neither is nor isn't. But everything is within her, so that the gods are her children. Everything you can think of, everything you can see, is the production of the goddess. Oh, this is a wonderful story. The Vedic gods are together, and they see a strange sort of amorphous thing down the way, like a kind of smoky fog. And they say, what's that? They don't know what it is. And Agni, the god of fire, says, I'll go find out who that is. So he goes up to this smoky thing, and he says, who are you? And from the smoky thing, the voice says, who are you? And he says, I'm Agni. I'm the Lord of Fire. I can burn anything. And out of the fog there comes a piece of straw. It falls on the ground. It says, let's see you burn that. He can't burn it. He goes back. He says, this is strange. Well, Vayu, the Lord of Wind, says, I'll try. So he goes. And the same thing. I can blow anything around. Throws it down. Let's see you blow that. Well, he can't. He goes back. Then a woman arrives, a beautiful, mysterious, mystic woman. And she instructs the gods and tells them who that is. That is the ultimate mystery of being, from which you, boys, have received your strength. And he can turn it on or off for you, you know. And there she comes as the one who illuminates the gods themselves concerning the ultimate ground of their own being.
It's the female wisdom.
It's the female as the giver of forms. She is the one who gave the forms, and she knows where they came from.
I wonder what it would have meant to us if somewhere along the way we had begun the prayer, our mother, instead of our father. What psychological difference would it have made?
Well, it makes a psychological difference in the character of the cultures. You have the basic birth of civilization in the Near East, with the great river valleys then as the main source areas, the Nile, the Tigris-Euphrates, and then over in India, the Indus Valley, and later the Ganges. This is the world of the goddess. All these rivers have goddess names, finally. Then there come the invasions. Now, these fighting people are herding people. The Semites are herders of goats and sheep, and the Indo-Europeans of cattle. They were formerly the hunters. They translate a hunting mythology into a herding mythology, but it's animal-oriented. And when you have hunters, you have killers. And when you have herders, you have killers, because they're always in movement, nomadic, coming into conflict with other people, and they have to conquer the area they move into. This comes into the Near East. And this brings in the warrior gods, like Zeus, like Yahweh.
The sword and death instead of fertility.
Right. Particularly the Hebrews. They really wipe out the goddess. The term for the goddess, the Canaanite goddess that's used in the Old Testament, is the abomination. And so many of the Hebrew kings are condemned in the Old Testament for having worshipped on the mountaintops. Mm-hmm. That's the goddess. And there was a very strong accent against the goddess in the Hebrew, which you do not find in the Indo-European. There you have Zeus marrying the goddess, yeah. and then the two play together. I think it's an extreme case that we have in the Bible. And our own Western subjugation of the female is really, I think, a function of biblical thinking.
Because when you substitute the male for the female, you get a different psychology, a different cultural bias.
Particularly if you cut the female out and don't have any... I mean, if the male is on top like this... And the female is the subordinate all the way, you have a totally different system from that when the two are facing each other.
And it's permissible in your culture to do what your gods do, so you just...
Well, that's exactly it. So I would see three situations here. One, the early one of the sheer goddess, when the male is hardly a significant divinity. You see, she is the total thing. And then this other one of the Hebrew, of the goddess, the male, the total thing. In fact, he takes over her role. And finally, then, the classical one, where the two are in interaction.
There are women today who say that the spirit of the goddess has been in exile for 5,000 years since the events.
Well, you can't put it that far back, 5,000 years. She was a very potent figure in Hellenistic times in the Mediterranean. And she came back with the Virgin in the Roman Catholic tradition. I mean, you don't have a tradition with the goddess celebrated any more beautifully and marvelously than in the 12th and 13th century French cathedrals, every one of which is called Notre Dame.
What about the virgin birth? Suddenly the goddess reappears in the form of the chaste and pure vessel chosen for God's action.
Well, in the history of Western religions, this is an extremely interesting development. The virgin birth comes in by way of the Greek tradition. When you read your four Gospels, the only one with the virgin birth in it is the Gospel according to Luke, and Luke was a Greek.
And there was in the Greek tradition images, legends, myths of virgin births?
All of them. I mean, the Leda and the swan and Persephone and the serpent and this one and that one and the other one. The virgin birth is represented throughout.
This was not a new idea then in Bethlehem?
No. What is the meaning of the virgin birth? In India, there's this the system of the Kundalini, as it's called, the idea of the centers, psychological centers up the spine, and they represent the psychological planes of concern and consciousness and action. The first is at the rectum, and this is that of alimentation. The serpent represents this, you know, a traveling esophagus going along just eating, 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 eating. And all of us, we wouldn't be here if we weren't eating. And then the second center is at the sex organ center, and that's the urge to procreation. The third center is at the navel. This is where you eat and want to consume. And it's not the alimentary eating, it's the mastering and smashing and the trashing of others. You see, this is the aggressive mood. Now, the first is an animal instinct. The second is an animal instinct. The third is an animal instinct. And these three centers are located in the pelvic basin, you see. Mm-hmm. The next one is at the level of the heart. And this is the opening of compassion. And there you move out of the field of animal action into a field that is properly human and spiritual. Now, in each of these centers, there is a symbolic form. At the base, the first one, there is the form of the lingam and yoni, the male and female organs in conjunction. At the heart chakra, there is again the male and female organs in conjunction, but in gold. This is the virgin birth. It's the birth of spiritual man out of the animal man. Do you understand?
And it happens
when you are awakened at the level of the heart to compassion and suffering with the other person. That's the beginning of humanity. And the meditations of religion properly are on that level, the heart level.
You say it's the beginning of humanity, but in these stories, that's the moment when gods are born, the virgin birth. It's a god who emerges from that chemistry.
And you know who that god is? It's you. All of the symbols in mythology refer to you. You can get stuck out there and think it's all out there. And so you think of Jesus and all the sentiments about how he suffered and all. What that suffering is what ought to be going on in you. Have you been reborn? Have you died to your animal nature and come to life as a human incarnation?
Why is it significant that this is of a virgin?
Well, it is that the begetter is the spirit. It is a spiritual birth. The virgin conceived of the word, but through the ear.
The word came like a shaft of
light. Yes. And now the Buddha was born from his mother's side at the level of the heart chakra. That's a symbolic birth. He wasn't born from his mother's side, but symbolically he was.
But the Christ came the way you and I come.
Yes, but of a virgin.
Which is a power greater than...
And then, according to Roman Catholic doctrine, her virginity was restored. So... nothing happened physically, you might say. It's not a physical birth. It's symbolic of a spiritual transformation. That's what the virgin birth's about. And so deities are born that way who represent beings who act in terms of compassion and not in terms of the lower three centers.
If you go back into antiquity, do you find images of the Madonna as the mother of the Savior child?
Well, what you have as the model for the Madonna actually is Isis with her child Horus at her breast. This was the actual model for the Madonna symbol.
Isis? Tell me that story.
This is a prime myth in this period of the goddess as the redeemer, the one who goes in quest of the lost spouse or lover, and through her loyalty and descent into the realm of death recovers him. Isis and her husband Osiris were twins who were born of the goddess Nut. And their younger relatives were Set and Nephthys, who were also twins born from Nut. Set planned to kill his brother Osiris. And he took Osiris's measurements secretly and had a wonderful sarcophagus built that would exactly fit Osiris. So there was a hilarious party in progress one time among the gods, and Set trots in this sarcophagus and he says, anyone whom this perfectly fits can have it as his sarcophagus. And everybody at the party tried. And when Osiris got in, of course, he perfectly fit. Just at that time, 72 accomplices come rushing out, and they clap the lid on and strap it together and throw it in the Nile. Now, this is the death of the god. Whenever you have a death of an incarnation, a god like this, you're going to have a resurrection. You can wait for that. So he goes floating down the Nile, and is washed ashore in Syria. And a beautiful tree grows up and incorporates the sarcophagus in its own trunk. So this is this wonderful tree with glorious aroma. And the local king has just had a son born to him. And he is also at the same time going to build a palace. The aroma of this tree is so wonderful. He cuts it down and brings it in to be a central pillar in the main room of the palace. Poor little Isis, whose husband has been thrown into the Nile, starts this wonderful quest for Osiris. So she comes to the place where the palace is and learns of the wonderful aroma, and she suspects this is Osiris, and she gets a job as nurse to the just-born little child. Well, then she lets the child nurse from her finger, and she loves the little child, and she decides to give it immortality. So she does this by placing him in the fireplace, in the fire, to burn away gradually his mortal body. But being a goddess, she could keep that from killing him, you understand? And when that would happen, she would convert herself into a swallow and fly mournfully around the pillar where her husband is. Well, one evening, the child's mother came into this room while this scene was in progress, saw her child in the fireplace, let out a scream, and that broke the spell, and they had to rescue the child from incineration. Meanwhile, the swallow had turned into this gorgeous nurse, Isis. And the nurse gave an explanation of the situation, and she said, by the way, it's my husband that's in that pillar there, and I'd be grateful if you could just let me take it home. So the king came in, and he said, certainly. So he removes the pillar, gives it to Isis, and it's put on a barge. So on the way back to the Nile, she removes the lid, the cover of the sarcophagus, and lies on top of her dead spouse and conceives of her dead spouse. This is an image that occurs in Egyptian art all the time. Out of death comes life and all of this kind of business. And when they land, she, in the papyrus swamp, gives birth to her child Horus, with the dead Osiris beside her. This is the motif for the Madonna, actually. It becomes the Madonna. In Egyptian symbology, Isis represents the throne. The pharaoh sits on the throne of Isis, as the child sits on the mother's lap. And when you look in the Cathedral of Chartres in the west portal, you will see the Madonna as the throne with the little child Jesus as the world emperor on her lap. That is the same image that's come over.
And you say the Christian fathers took this image?
Definitely, and they really say so. You read the second letter of Peter, and he says, those forms which were merely mythological forms in the past are now incarnate and actual in our Savior. It was a mythology of the Savior, the dead and resurrected God. And it's associated with the moon, which dies and is resurrected every month. And you have the three nights dark, and you have Christ 3 nights in the tomb, and 3 days in the tomb, and all this kind of thing. It's an intentional saying that which was merely talked about is now fact. And no one knows what the date of Christmas ought to be, but it's put on the date of the summer, of the winter solstice, when the nights begin to be shorter and the days longer, the birth of light. And so there is a idea of death to the past and birth to the future in our lives and in our thinking all the time. Death to the animal nature, birth to the spiritual, and these symbols are talking about it one way or another.
So when the
the goddess is the one who brings it about. The second birth is through the second mother. Notre Dame de Paris, Notre Dame de Chartres, our mother church. We are reborn by entering and leaving a church.
And it doesn't mean physically, it means
spiritually.
That there's a power that's unique to the feminine principle.
It can be put that way. It's not necessarily unique to her. You can have a rebirth through the male also. But using this system of symbols, the woman becomes the regenerator.
There's that wonderful saying in the New Testament of Jesus, in Jesus there is no male or female. In the ultimate sense of things, there is neither.
It would have to be. I mean, if Jesus represents the source of our being, we are all, as it were, thoughts in the mind of Jesus. He is the Word that has become flesh in us, too.
You and I would possess characteristics that are both male and female.
Well, actually, the body does. But sometime in the fetal period, it becomes apparent that this is going to be male and this is going to be female. Meanwhile, it's a kind of neutral body with the potentialities for either inflection.
So all through life, we are honoring or suppressing one or the other.
And in that yin-yang figure from China, you know, in the dark fish or whatever you want to call it, there's a light spot, and in the light one, there's a dark spot. That's how they can relate. You couldn't relate at all to something that of which you did not participate, into which you did not participate at all. That's why the idea of God as the absolute other is a ridiculous idea. There could be no relationship to that which is absolute other.
But the question arises, discussing the male-female principle, the virgin birth, the spiritual power that gives us the second birth. The wise people of all time have said that we can live the good life if we learn, in fact, to live spiritually. But how does one learn to live spiritually when one is of the flesh? Remember Paul said the desires of the flesh are against the spirit and the desires of the spirit are against the flesh. How do we learn to live spiritually?
Well, that was in ancient times and in primitive times, the business of the teacher. He was to give you the clues to a spiritual life. That was what the priest was for. Also, that was what the ritual was for. A ritual can be defined as an enactment of a myth. By participating in a good, sound ritual, you are actually experiencing a mythological life. And it's out of that that one can learn to live spiritually.
These stories of mythology actually point the way to the spiritual life.
Yes, you've got to have a clue. You've got to have a road map of some kind. And these are all around us. They're here.
And the road map to which the goddess stories are pointing is the map of elevating the spiritual to an equality with the physical so that you live in union with those two.
Yes, there you come to the real sanctity of the earth itself, because that is the body of the goddess. When Yahweh creates, he creates of the earth and breathes his life into it. He's not there. She's there. Your body is her body. And there's that kind of identity.
Well, that's why I'm not so sure that the future of the race and the salvation of the journey is in space. I think it is well right here on Earth, in the body, in the womb of all of our being.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, when you go out into space, what you're carrying is your body, and if that hasn't been transformed, space won't transform it for you. But thinking about space may help you to realize something.
You certainly thought about space in this wonderful passage. You're describing a page out of the National Geographic Atlas of the World, but you read this and something happened to you.
What these pages opened to me was the vision of a universe of unimaginable magnitude and inconceivable violence. Billions upon billions, literally, of roaring thermonuclear furnaces scattering from each other, each thermonuclear furnace being a star, and our sun among them. Many of them actually blowing themselves to pieces, littering the outermost reaches of space with dust and gas, out of which new stars with circling planets are being born right now. And then from still more remote distances beyond all these, there come murmurs, microwaves, which are echoes of the greatest cataclysmic explosion of all, namely the Big Bang of creation, which according to recent reckonings must have occurred some 18 billion years ago. That's where we are, kiddo. And to realize that, you realize how really important you are, you know. One little micro bit in this great magnitude. And then out of that must come the experience that you and that are in some sense one, and you partake of all of that.
And it begins here.
It begins here.
This has been a Highbridge Audio presentation.
Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. Program 6, Masks of Eternity.
We want to think about God. God is a thought. God is an idea. But its reference is to something that transcends all thinking. I mean, he's beyond being, beyond the category of being and non-being. Is he or is he not? Neither is nor is not. Every god, every mythology, every religion is true in this sense. It is true as metaphorical of the human and cosmic mystery. He who thinks he knows doesn't know. He who knows that he doesn't know, knows. There is an old story that is still good. The story of the quest, the spiritual quest. That is to say, to find the inward thing which you basically are. All of the symbols in the mythology refer to you. Have you been reborn? Have you died to your animal nature and come to life as a human incarnation? You are God in your deepest identity. You are one with the transcendent.
Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. Masks of Eternity.
The images of God are many. Joseph Campbell called them the masks of eternity and said they both cover and reveal the face of glory. All our names and images for God are masks, Campbell said. They signify that ultimate reality, which by definition transcends language and art. A myth is a mask of God too, a metaphor for what lies behind the visible world. As teacher, scholar, and writer, Joseph Campbell spent his life in the study of comparative religion. He wanted to know what it means that God assumes such different masks in different cultures. We go east of Suez and see people dancing before a bewildering array of fantastic gods. When those people come here, well, Campbell told the story of the young Hindu who called on him in New York and said, "When I visit a foreign country, I like to acquaint myself with its religion. So I bought myself a Bible, and for some months now I've been reading it from the beginning. But you know, I can't find any religion in it." Campbell, who became president of the American Society for the Study of Religion, was at home in the sacred scriptures of all the world's great faiths. He found comparable stories in them, stories of creation, of virgin births, incarnations, death and resurrection, second comings, judgment days. Quoting one of his favorite Hindu scriptures, which he translated from the Sanskrit, he concluded that truth is one. The sages speak of it by many names. Joseph Campbell began his journey into this literature of the spirit after his imagination was excited by a visit to the Museum of Natural History in New York when he was just a boy. We met there a few months before his death and talked through a long evening about the masks of eternity.
Is there something in common in every culture that creates this need for God?
Well, I think anyone who has an experience of mystery at all knows that there is a dimension, let's say, of the universe that is not that which is available to his senses. There's a wonderful saying in one of the Upanishads, before a sunset, or a mountain, and the beauty of this or of that, you pause and say, ah, that is participation in divinity. And I think that's what it is. It's the realization of wonder, and also the experience of tremendous power, which people, of course, living in the world of nature, are experiencing all the time. You know, there's something there that's much bigger than the human dimension. And our way of thinking in the West largely is that God is the source of the energy. The way in most Oriental thinking, and I think in most what we call primitive thinking also, is that God is a manifestation of the energy, not its source. That God is the vehicle of the energy. And the level of energy that is involved or represented determines the character of the God. There are gods of violence. There are gods of compassion. There are gods that unite the two. There are gods that are the protectors of kings in their war campaigns. These are personifications of the energy that's in play. And what the source of the energy is, what's the source of the energy of these lights around us? I mean, this is a total mystery.
Doesn't this make of faith an anarchy, a sort of continuing war among principalities?
As life is, yes. I mean, even in your mind, when it comes to do anything, there will be a war, a decision as to priorities, what you're to do now. Or in relationship to other people, there will be four or five possibilities of my way of action. And the notion of divinity or divine life in my mind would be what would determine my decision. And if it were rather crude, it would be a rather crude decision.
But is divinity just what we think?
Yes.
What does that do to faith?
Well, it's a tough one about faith.
You are a man of faith. You're a man of wonder. And...
Yeah, I don't have to have faith. I have experience.
What kind of experience?
Well, I have experience of the wonder of the life. I have experience of love. I have experience of hatred, malice. I like to punch the guy's jaw. And I admit this. But those are different divinities, I mean, from the point of view of a symbolic imaging. Those are different images operating in me. For instance, when I was a little boy and was being brought up a Roman Catholic, I was told I had a guardian angel on my right side and a tempting devil on my left. And when it came to making a decision of what I would do, the decision would depend on which one had most influence on me. And I must say that in my boyhood, and I think also in the people who were teaching me, they actually concretized those thoughts.
They did what?
It was an angel. That angel is a fact, and the devil is a fact, do you see? Otherwise, one thinks of them as metaphors for the energies that are afflicting and guiding you.
And those energies come from?
From your own life. The energy of your own body, the different organs in your body, including your head, are the conflict systems.
And your life comes from where?
Yeah, there you are. From the ultimate energy that's the life of the universe. And then you say, well, somebody has to generate that. Why do you have to say that? Why can't it be impersonal? That would be Brahman. That would be the transcendent mystery that you can also personify.
Can men and women live with an impersonality?
Yes. They do all over the place. Just go east of Suez. In the east, the gods are much more elemental.
Elemental?
Elemental. Less human and more like the powers of nature. I see a deity as representing an energy system. And part of the energy system is the human energy systems of love and malice, hate, benevolence, compassion. And in Oriental thinking, the god is the vehicle of the energy, not its source.
Well, of course, the heart of the Christian faith is that these elemental forces you're talking about embodied themselves in a human being and reconciling mankind to God.
Yes. And the basic Buddhist idea is that that is true of you as well. And that what Jesus was a person who realized that in himself and lived out of the Christhood of his nature.
What do you think about Jesus?
We just don't know. Jesus. All we know are four contradictory texts that tell us what he did.
Written many years after he lived.
But I think we know what Jesus said. I think the sayings of Jesus are probably pretty close. But when you read the Thomas Gospel, the Gospel according to Thomas, which was dug up there in that with those other Gnostic texts, it has all the flavor of one of the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, or Luke, except that it doesn't say quite the same thing. There's one wonderful passage. It's the last one in the gospel, actually. When will the kingdom come? Now, in Mark 13, I think it is, we hear that the end of the world is going to come. That's to say, a mythological image, that's the end of the world, is taken as a reference to an actual physical historical fact to be. When you read the Thomas Gospel, Jesus says, the kingdom of the Father will not come by expectation. The kingdom of the Father is spread upon the earth, and men do not see it. So I look at you now in that sense, and the radiance of the presence of the divine is known to me through you.
Through me?
You, sure.
A journalist?
Jesus also says in this text, he who drinks from my mouth will become as I am, and I shall be he. He's talking from the point of view of that being of beings which we call the Christ, who is the being of all of us. And anyone who lives in relation to that is as Christ. And anyone who incarnates, or rather brings into his life the message of the word, is equivalent to Jesus. That's the sense there.
So that's what you mean when you say, I am radiating God to you.
You are. Yes.
And you to me.
And I'm speaking this seriously.
No, I take it seriously. I happen to believe the same as you without being able to articulate it as you do. I do sense that there is divinity. The divinity is in the other.
So you are the vehicle. You are, as it were, radiant of the Spirit. And that's why not recognize it.
I'll tell you what the most gripping scripture in the Christian New Testament is for me. It says, I believe, help thou my unbelief.
I believe in what?
I believe in this ultimate reality. And that I can experience it, that I do experience it. But I don't have answers to my questions. I believe in the question. Is there a God?
I had a very amusing experience, which it might be well worth telling. I was in the New York Athletic Club swimming pool. And you know, you don't wear your collar this way or that way when you're in a swimming pool. And I was introduced to a priest. This is Father so-and-so. This is Joseph Campbell. I'm a professor. He's a professor at one of our Catholic universities. So after I'd had my swim, I came and sat down beside, in what we call, you know, the horizontal athlete situation, and the priest is beside me. And he said, Mr. Campbell, are you a priest? I said, no, Father. He said, are you a Catholic? I said, I was, Father. He said, and now he had the sense to ask it this way, do you believe in a personal God? I said, no, Father. And he said, well, I suppose there is no way to prove by logic the existence of a personal God. And I said, if there were, Father, what would be the value of faith? Well, Mr. Campbell, it's nice to have met you. And he was off. I really felt I'd done a jujitsu trick there. But that was a very illuminating conversation to me. The fact that he asked, do you believe in a personal God? Mm-hmm. That meant that he also recognized the possibility of the Brahman, mm-hmm. of the transcendent energy.
Well, then what is religion?
Well, the word religion means religio, linking back the phenomenal person to a source. If we say it is the one life in both of us, then my separate life has been linked to the one life, religio, linked back.
And this
becomes symbolized in the images of religion, which represent that connecting link.
Your friend Jung, the great psychologist, says that the most powerful religious symbol is the circle. He says, The circle is one of the great primordial images of mankind, that in considering the symbol of the circle, we are analyzing the self. And I find you in your own work throughout the course of your life coming across the circle, whether it's in the magical designs the world over, whether it's in the architecture, both ancient and modern, whether it's in the dome-shaped temples of India or the calendar stones of the Aztecs or the ancient Chinese bronze shields or the visions of the Old Testament prophet Ezekiel, whom you talk about, the wheel in the sky. You keep coming across this image.
Yeah, it's an ever-present thing. It's the center from which you've come, back to which you go. I remember reading in a book about the American Indians called The Indian Book by Natalie Curtis. It was published around 1904. Her conversation with a chief, I think he was a chief of the Pawnee tribe. And among the things he said was, when we pitch camp, we pitch a camp in a circle. When we look at the horizon is in a circle. When the eagle builds a nest, the nest is in a circle. And then you read in Plato somewhere, the soul is a circle. I suppose the circle represents a totality. Within the circle is one thing. It is encircled. It's enframed. That would be the spatial aspect. But the temporal aspect of the circle is you leave, go somewhere, and come back. The Alpha and Omega. God is the Alpha and Omega. The source and the end. Somehow the circle suggests immediately a completed totality, whether in time or in space.
No beginning, no end.
Well, round and round and round. The year. Well, this is November again, you know, and we're about to have Thanksgiving again, and we're about to have Christmas again. And then not only the year, but the month, the moon cycle, and the day, the cycle. And we're reminded of this when we look on our watch and see the cycle of time. It's the same hour, but another day, and all that sort of thing.
Why do you suppose the circle became so universally symbolic?
Well, because it's experienced all the time. The experience in the day and the year, just as we've said, and you experience it in leaving home, going on your adventure, hunting, or whatever it may be, and coming back to home. And then there's a deeper one also, that mystery of the womb and the tomb. When people are buried, it's for rebirth. I mean, that's the origin of the burial idea. You're put back into the womb of Mother Earth for rebirth.
And Jung kept returning to that theme of the circle as being the sort of universal symbol.
Well, Jung used it as a pedagogical device, actually, he called the mandala. This was actually a Hindu term for a sacred circle.
Here is one of the pictures.
That's a very elaborate mandala. You have the deity, the center, with the power source, the illumination source, and these are the manifestations or aspects of its radiance. But in working out a mandala for oneself, what one does is draw a circle and then think of the different impulse systems in your life, the different value systems in your life, and try then to compose them and find what a center is. It's a kind of discipline for pulling all those scattered aspects of your life together, finding a center and ordering yourself to it. So you're trying to coordinate your circle with the universal circle.
To be at the center.
At the center. The Navajo have that wonderful image of what they call the pollen path. And when you realize what pollen is, it's the life source. And it's a single path. The center. And then they were saying, oh, beauty before me, beauty behind me, beauty to the right of me, beauty to the left of me, beauty above me, beauty below me. I'm on the pollen path. So the little cosmos of one's own life and the macrocosm of the world's life are in some way to be coordinated. Well, for instance, among the Navajo Indians, healing ceremonies were conducted.